So, I've been having a lot of phone calls with Dave Green, who is one of the main organizers for this, and my co-editor on ATK. And they've been kind of one-sided, and I've been deliberately trying to do that, because I did not want to talk about this talk at all. So I'd encourage him to chat a little about the conference and so forth. And the last one went very, very, very well, because I was saying, well, you know, how's it going? And Dave was, well, you know, I'm really pleased by how it's turning out. We've got a lot of good speakers. And the thing I like about them, Danny, is they're not namby-pamby kind of speakers. You know, it's all tied to the practice and use of technologies, grounded in facts, that kind of thing. And yet, there's none of this hand-wavy stuff going on. So what's your talk going to be about? And I start explaining, because it's probably about time that I explain what the keynote's going to be. And I mean, you know, I'm talking and I go, well, you know, it's going to be about fame and the public sphere and the private relative. And he's going, you're kind of fading in and out. I realize at that point that my hands were cartwheeling. So this is going to be the hand wavy talk, I'm afraid. The rest of it's going to be, you know, basically NASA technical papers, preprints of BMG stuff, you know, so double-blinded the presenters don't even know that they're presenting their papers yet. And then we blind them, so that's double-blinded. But this is very much a work in progress, and has been for the 6 months that I've been faking that it's been done today. But I do have an excuse. I have an incredibly good excuse, which is, as a geek, I slightly underestimated the social awkwardness about the topic I was going to address, which was not network preferences. So here was the plan. Let me give you my inspiration for this. This is Everybody Loves Eric S. Raymond, which many of you will already have recognized. This is a comic strip devoted entirely to a sort of sitcom family environment with Richard M. Stallman, Linus Torvalds, and Eric S. Raymond, who always turns up in my talks for some reason, usually with a gun. This got me thinking, because when I did Life Hacks, part of the kind of really, essentially, the joke of Life Hacks is that I went out and interviewed these people who were like super prolific, super famous geeks, you know. And whenever I did the talk, you know, I'd say, and I said, I don't like having RMS on the screen that long. You get kind of monitor burn-in with that kind of stuff. And I spoke to Guido Van Roosen, and you know, and half the audience would sort of ironically go, yay, Guido Van Roosen, yay! And the Ruby people will be plotting. And the other thing is that people will be genuinely impressed and like come up to me afterwards and go, so seriously, what's Guido like? And I found this and the comic strips and the fact that we've created an entire culture that has the kind of infrastructure of fame for people who in a more civilized age would be hundred and quartered. No, would really be, you know, minor celebrities. They wouldn't have like songs written about them. There wouldn't be filth about them. And you see this in preceding cultures, and there are RMS songs, believe you me. And kids drawing in crayon send it off to them. And we have this sort of weird micro-celebrity culture. And of course, the more you look on the web, the more you see this sort of thing appearing in other spaces. The geeks kind of have a bit of a lead on this. But in almost any environment on the net, somebody starts a blog for like 10 minutes, and if you have a comment system, either you have like the deadline of a website where nobody really turns up ever, or you get this strange cultural formation where people start obsessively tracking people, or actively stalking them, or the opposite, flaming them, taking them apart. And so what you have is a situation of sort of micro-celebrity sphere going around. And my theory was this. I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if fame is becoming more evenly distributed? Wouldn't it be interesting if we've kind of existed so far in a world where we have kind of mega fame up here, and then we have like normal social relationships down here, and now we're filling up this curve, And basically, if I can get a power curve out of this, I could probably tour the lecture circuit for the next 5 years. So that was my situation. So I was very enthusiastic about doing this. And unfortunately, I approached it the same way as I approached Life Hacks, which is I went around and basically, you know, spoke to people. I went, hi, I'd like to talk about how famous you are. And this was terrible because these were people who were living their life relatively in public, and they immediately clammed up. They went, I'm not that famous at all. I'm very popular. And would not speak of it at all. And in groups, this was even worse. I would have these, I kind of did this with the Life Hacks thing. I would do these like experimental things, and basically it was like giving a talk on being fabulous, right? I'd walk in and go, I'm doing this research in being famous, in being fabulous, and I wondered if anybody here was fabulous or had some experiences about being fabulous. And no one, you know, no one would ever say anything. Except for like two or three people who go, yeah, I'm fabulous, and then talk for about three quarters of an hour. And everyone else just go, whack. I won't name names because this is true. People would just go on for ages about how famous they were. And this was not giving me solid data. So I'm afraid this talk is rather thin on solid data. But what it made me think is maybe I have to couch this term, this study is something that is a bit more empty of the sort of social ramifications of being famous. So I think, let's see if I can remember what keyword I used for this. this is Merlin fucking Mann doing this to me. So my role was this. Must have been pretty early on when I was writing this bit. Maybe I should have a camera. You know, a little bit of a sneak preview. Okay, so it's like the opposite of need to know. So this is the rule, right? This is the rule of internet fame, or really fame whittled out of all the social ideas that we have about it, that it makes you important and big and clever, and actually famous, because the people I'm talking about tend to be micro-famous, famous for only a few people. And the rule is this, that there are people out there who know something about you, and you have relatively little knowledge about them. Just this formulation gives us a few little bits of information. One, I mean, this is clearly not new. There are clearly a lot of situations where this is the case. But this is definitely something that we recognize that the technology that we've invented kind of encourages, right? So the person who knows about you know, is at your Life Journal, right? Or is at your Source Project site, or is reading the emails that you've put out on your mailing list. And, you know, what do you know about them? Well, you know the referrer, and you know the IP address, and you know the date that they arrived. And this scales down a lot better than fame as well. Because now we have this idea that, you know, even if you only got 10 hits on your website, that's 10 people who now know much more about you than you do about them. And this is one of the things that gives the sort of social results that I was kind of spotting when I was initially looking into this, which was actually at the last, what were we calling it then? At the last talk, a social interaction that I recognized quite a lot in these situations happened, which is that you saw people going up to one another very tentatively and sort of saying, so what have you done then? And really, it was a 50-50 toss-up coin, because the person would sit there going, I wrote, maybe you have known me from such popular programs as Bike Tracker, you know, or Round Trip, or something like that. And the other person would go, wow, that's you, of course, yeah, now I know you. Or they would go, I'm sorry, I don't know. And you could see the faces going up and down in the awkwardness. And this is the nature of microfame. This is this odd social relationship you have with people, and perhaps you will have this when you leave the amphitheater today, that you'll go up and have this odd relationship with people who know more about you than you know about them. And the process will hopefully reverse itself. at some point as well. So this is clearly also a power relationship, which, and I don't mean the curve, I mean the actual power relationship. And it, but it's not entirely clear where the relationship is. It's not entirely clear who is the top here and who is the bottom. Because if somebody goes up to you and says, you know, I know something about you, they kind of have the lead there. So this was so having boiled this down into this kind of this role, I'm now going to be enthusiastically hand-wavy about this, about what I see essentially as a data asymmetry. This is the most technical way I could come up with of explaining FAI. It's an information asymmetry, and I'm going to be very hand-wavy, and I'm going to be very depressing about it. So it's going to be lots of. How this spreads, how it relates to traditional FAI, and how we're all screwed. Okay, so these people are not your friends, and that seems a rather rash and rude way of describing it, but it's definitely a different relationship to the relationship you have with your normal social circle, where almost by definition your normal social circle is a much more bypassed app. Bilateral sort of communication, but there are some interesting aspects of this which kind of imply that they may evolve from your friendships. I've been studying high school girls, and for very good reasons. Well, whenever I talked about fame and all this kind of thing, people always went, "Oh God, it's I don't want to get into this. This is very high school." And this is clearly, you know, those kind of like cliques and ideas of things come from high school. And also, it's very interesting talking to people now who are in high school, because they're going through that cliquiness and their social relationship stuff, using the technology that we idiots have invented. And the conversation that I had recently with a high school girl and I, was she was talking about basically the superior clique, the people who, within the micro confines of a high school, are the famous people, the ones that everybody knows about, and they just, you know, they don't know you at all. And she said that a lot of these people even had like journal accounts, and had hundreds of friends, because obviously friending then becomes a sort of currency in this environment. And the way she described it is that basically their posts were effectively press releases. That they would just send out 100 people announcing what they were doing, providing the information, and, you know, no need to comment or anything like this. Okay, so what time is it? We're about halfway through. It's time now for, yes, it's 3:53 a.m. You may notice I am still on Pacific daylight here. So I have a choice here in hand waviness, in that I have to quickly come up with a picture here that conveys that somehow all of this very namby-pamby I've been talking to high school girls about is based in scientific fact. I have three choices. I can either give a picture of the internet cloud. I love this. I just grab this stuff from Google Images, but I love the meta nature of this. The metaphor of cloud is often used. Slide 4. I can use that. I can use the long tail. We can bifurcate. It's like choose your own adventure, isn't it? We can bifurcate that here. But the one I'm going to choose to give a kind of vaguely scientific feel to my inventions here is. It's the Dunbar graph. Who knows the Dunbar number? People go, yes, I've faked knowledge on this too. Okay, so the Dunbar number is basically the academic version of my hand waving. The Dunbar number is a thing done by Robin Dunbar, who, what you're looking at here is a bunch of monkeys. And the X here shows you the ratio of the neocortex, which is basically the part of the brain that monkeys use for grooming management and social relationships, basically grooming. And this is the mean group size, and as you can see, there's a sort of correlation here. And Robin did was he extrapolated this and basically worked out how many people should be in the average human group, and the answer is 150. And, or 147.8. for an average-sized brain. And then Robin wrote a bunch of very interesting books, which I've read the summaries and basically it's kind of like 42. I mean, I don't want to dismiss people who actually have done research compared to me, but it's very like sort of like, ooh, there's 150 here. I think you'll notice that in World of Warcraft, 150 is exactly the number of people you need to get past the 150 people required strategy. 150, you see. But basically the argument is that that we use language as a sort of grooming mechanism to cope with 150, otherwise it would just be continual queues at the toilet. After 150, society kind of collapses. And that we can kind of know, I can know all of you, roughly, but 151, he's nobody, right? Now it's all very confusing. So this is kind of interesting from this point of view, because there are two things that are kind of significant about this. One, I mean, I'm a geek. Many of us are. So my Dunbar number is about 6. So after 6, like basically you have to have like something really majorly wrong with your head or something for me to even recognize that you're a different person. Right? Don't cut your hair, because that really throws me. So we have fairly low Dunbar numbers. So after that, we kind of need systems to cope with large numbers of people, often involving hiding under the table. The other thing that's significant is, of course, software doesn't have a Dunbar number. Or if it does, it's 665,535, right? Error. And of course, because geeks don't really factor in things like social affordances, things like buddy lists and Friendster and so on, all of these things we use to cope with the social world, basically just clock through, just go 150, 151, 152. And this is what you see in the live general scenario that I've just painted, right? These people have so many friends, so many friendsters, shall we call them, that they're now dealing with, that they're now having to come up with coping mechanisms to groom all of these people. Now, there's a guy called Christopher Allen, who, if you Google for him, you'll hit his blog. And he's done some really interesting studies into the effects of the Dunbar number, or at least predictions about the Dunbar number and its use in software. And one of the things he points out, to try and help geeks along, is how people in normal society cope with Dunbar overload when you overdo your buffers and go over the Dunbar number. Now, of course, there are lots of people in society who have to cope with this. There are, for instance, doctors. Right? Doctors have to groom a lot of people. And so they're very narrow in what they know about them. So they're basically looking at the medicine board and just going, okay, right, you're there, but you have to go through. Politicians have a whole system of ways of chunking their Dunbar number. So before they go into a room, they don't know who the hell you are, but they have their assistants. They explain who you are. You say, I'm very, how's your wife, your beautiful wife, Dora, your beautiful children, Fred and Sheila, and then they go on to the next one. So they have a chunking system for this. Marketing people have really interesting coping strategies for the fact that they need to pretend to be friendly with more than 150 people. And they have, you know, and if you've ever talked to a marketing person and not you know, started screaming, they have very interesting stories to tell about how, for instance, they'll do refreshes of each of them. They'll go through the list, often the only social software that does cope with this kind of thing is marketing software. They'll have a little thing that blinks up, says you need to talk to this person, you haven't talked to them for 3 months or not. But most of the software we've created has not had these kind of affordances. Except for, interestingly, the web and the net, where there's this obvious shortcut to use, which is this is the newsletter, is the press release, is the broadcast. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the social system that a lot of people adopted was basically an academic paper forwarding mechanism. Right? That if you're beginning to clock more and more people, as the technology gives you early affordance to do, and I should probably hurry up, but there's some really interesting studies in this, which I can vouch for personally, always the best kind of anecdata. For instance, people people these days, high school children again, and I'm not entirely obsessed, but high school children going on into college are keeping friends with their high school friends much more often than they used to. And the theory behind this is that you can basically groom your high school friends by text messaging them much more easily. You stay in contact while you go on. When I moved to America, I didn't make many friends in America because they're horrible. and also because I was on these British mailing lists, right? So I continued to have all of my old friends. So we have this system where the double number is kind of being messed with. You have all these buddies, you have all these people. What's the best way of dealing with that? You're kind of pushed into the situation of announcing things to the world. And what announcing things to the world has the quality of is microphone. This is information asymmetry again. You're basically sitting there going, here is all this information about you, and all your friends are going, oh, that's nice. This is good, right? This is good that we can increase our numbers. Being someone who knows a lot of people in our society is quickly recognized as, you know, the path to success, how to make friends and influence people. It's excellent to give your information in public so that people recognize you and people approach you and people go, wow, I am not worthy. So, more anecdata. Another group of people that I got quite interested in is my fetish is in a nutshell, is librarians turned detectives. And there's a whole subscription website. Librarians turned detectives are this interesting new group of people, right? Because basically, librarians these days have all the skills required to do everything that private investigators used to do. Because private investigators, you know, used to sit with telephoto lens taking pictures of divorcees and stuff. Whereas now, really the best way of investigating someone is just to, you know, riffle through the databases. Or in the case of the woman I actually interviewed about this, she said basically being a librarian is the best social engineering position to adopt ever. Because you phone up people and go, I'm just a little old librarian, and I wanted you to help me give you me all the information on this business. And people are just groupies. They get a lot of calls from librarians. This is a perfect disguise to adopt. So I was sort of asking, well, okay, what kind of jobs do you get? And in particular, what are the jobs that pay really well? What are the equivalents of divorce cases in the librarian detective world? And she said, well, okay, here's one that I have a regular retainer for. I have a client who, for reasons that will become apparent, I won't reveal the name of, but he's a fairly prominent person. He's you know, in one of those top 100 rich people lists. And my job is that he keeps me on a retainer to investigate himself. It's very Philip K. Dick. And basically what she does on a fairly regular basis is applies all her techniques to investigating him. She goes through all the databases, turns out all the data is a home address, what charities he's involved in, what businesses he's involved in, and all the dirt she can possibly pull up. And then she reports to him. And she in fact does two things. She does this, first of all, using the kind of paid-for subscription databases that she has access to. And those are kind of an interesting story themselves. And then she just does an open source in a kind of investigative way, which is basically go out onto the internet and use free databases. And I said, well, okay, what's the difference between those? What's the difference in the results? And she said, about 3 days. If you go on private databases, you can get stuff quicker. It takes a little bit longer if you just go and Google. Of course, the reason why he's doing this is because he wants his privacy. And by having somebody constantly circuiting around him, he can find out where the information leaks are and remove that asymmetry and disappear into the background. And one of the things, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, so we have an association between fame and fortune in our heads. And this is a very contingent connection. There's an awful lot of people who are very, very rich, who are very, very absent from the world. There's a secret grove in the hills of Silicon Valley that I once drove entirely accidentally into. I was trying to get to Lick Observatory. And we just turned up and we turned the wrong corner and we just walked into basically this like Shangri-La, this incredibly beautiful, incredibly expensive buildings. And I was talking to someone else who lived in the Silicon Valley area, and she explained that this was the secret billionaires. These were the secret people who had their own little community and only ever reached out into the wider community when they wanted to stop something. And basically they own like a bunch of the this is being recorded, it's now going to get killed. But the classic example of this is, what do they call them? When you have freeways, as you say in your country, and carpools. So the carpools in Silicon Valley go up San Jose, up San Jose, up San Jose, and then they stop. And then they start up again in San Francisco. And this is because the very rich of Silicon Valley leaned out and went, no, we don't want carpools for God knows what mysterious reasons. So you have the silent billionaires. And basically what I'm trying to convey here is that a public existence is not an unalloyed good. Even though the people we associate with a public existence are traditionally very famous and very rich people, there are a lot of people who pay quite a lot of money for the security of privacy. More anecdata. The wrong kind of fame. Okay. How long have I got? I've got 15, 20 minutes. Something like
that?
15. Seriously? Should I talk about Diana? It's not exactly high tech, is it? It kind of is. So I'll just get this up because I've always wanted to tell this story amongst people who might somehow appreciate it. Queen of Hearts. In 1997, I was stuck in America on one of my first early visits to be stuck in America, and Dave was manning the shop doing NTK, and Princess Diana died, which apparently was a big thing. I was completely oblivious to it, and I was having another one of these transatlantic phone calls, and Dave saying, "I need your advice on something." So Princess Diana died about a week ago, and basically everyone here is like dressing up as her, her old clothes, and just seeing Princess Diana faces leaping in front of them everywhere. And there's a funeral procession. The funeral procession is very long, and they've had to extend it, and they've extended it past my house. and it's just going to go past my house, and they're setting up the TV cameras here and everything. What if we got a sign? www.ntk.net. And just when Princess Diana is coming and stepped past this, I'll just leap out and wave it. For a brief moment, we would be the biggest URL on the world. I looked this up, and apparently 2.5 billion people watched Diana's thing. And when we would, we would be there. We would be dead, admittedly, shortly afterwards. I was a long way away. We decided against it in the end. Partly because, we were obviously going to get stoned. Partly because we went, the server's not going to take it. And it's true. No, this was us at the time. This is us, fairly simple thing. And we could have optimized it and got rid of the images. it would still have gone down. And the reason I bang on endlessly about this is because this is this weird switch. Talked a bit about how fame and fortune are necessarily connected on the net and in these environments, more so then, but still the case now. You can be famous without making money, and it actually costs you money to give this information away. If we restrict fame to this idea of this information asymmetry, you're actually paying people effectively to give this information away. Let's pictures of famous people. If you haven't seen them enough. Another one, maybe it's my old Doe instinct going. I like this image because this is actually from Madonna.com at the moment. And you can see the pearl This is what I like about this. This is actually the screenshot. If you go to the website, they have like a C dollar rock star in dollar album and in year zero. Can you see it's going? So Madonna poses an interesting question about fame, which is and the current idea of fame, which is that is Madonna actually several hundred million times better than the average session musician? Does she deserve the kind of millions that she gets? Also, equally, it's somebody like O.J. Simpson, who is also famous, can also turn that into money. Should he get the kind of money that he inevitably does simply by being famous, even if it's, you know, famous for being a murderer? Or not a murderer, a legend. But you know, no, I mean, you know, just the reputation. I'll speak to my lawyers later. And this is one of these awkward things we have with fame at the moment, because fame and fortune are very tightly bound now. You basically can proceed from one to the other very easily. There's a great book called The Frenzy of Renown that gives a history of fame. And it points out that this wasn't always the case. The fame and fortune were tangentially linked, but not linked in the way that we accustom ourselves to linking them now. Originally, the idea of fame and power being connected was basically you were already powerful. And therefore, fame was a kind of hobby, a kind of exploration that you would pursue. Fame was something that the rich bought for themselves by employing and patronizing writers to create for them, from sort of Augustus onwards in Western civilization. And then you have this kind of stealing away of the idea of fame by writers who were essentially poor, but realized that they could pull away posterity and fame from famous people by documenting themselves and recording themselves, because they actually had the power. They were the people who were creating fame and reputation for their masters. And then you have this interesting struggle in the democratization of fame as writers and creatives and artists basically latched on first to the idea of early ideas of intellectual property and then onto mass production. And it's a great ride for the creative force there. That they suddenly went from being the people who had control of fame to the people who had a certain degree of the control of their own fortune as connected. How long have I got now?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Oh, okay. All right. So I should probably sort of wrap this up. So the reason I bang on endlessly about this, apart from I'm still thinking about this idea, is that now we're in a very different situation. Now, not only is fame and fortune kind of divorced in the server burning out kind of way, but and this is I didn't use the long tail, so I'll just use a Chris Anderson quote, who's the editor of Wired. Who came up with the long tail, and said this as a sort of throwaway comment. I'm not entirely sure it's completely true, but it certainly has a grain of truth to it, which is most content producers, which are humans, I believe, given a choice between a smaller paid distribution and a larger unpaid distribution, will choose larger unpaid. So now we have this idea that fame and fortune are actually kind of mutually contradictory. And if you again think of the information asymmetry thing, this makes complete sense. If you're somebody who wants to be famous, who wants to have that information asymmetry, pumping out information is the best thing you can do, because you spread knowledge about yourself. If you're somebody who is pursuing the traditional model of getting paid for your information, for your content, then your temptation is to hoard these things. And then you're caught in this awful double bind about how much do you hoard? And you know, basically, whole business models are collapsing and being built on this idea as we proceed, where people are sitting there going, well, do I let everybody have my information to begin with, have all the content they do, and I'll just give that away freely, become very famous, and then I'll start holding them, and I'll get the money. Or do you have little split-off ideas, things that won't actually be proportionally connected to the information? It'll be simply my reputation that I make money on, out of advertising and so forth. So it isn't actually tied directly to the information. Or what? What do I do? Please help me, God. And this is the dilemma that content producers are going through. But of course, we're not those people. One of the problems that those people have is they're essentially performers and actors and, to a lesser extent, writers, but all those people who are essentially trying to trade on their personality already have sunk costs, right? Because they're creating a public persona to sell. So in many ways, they have to recoup that cost. This is their career they're talking about. Now, the rest of us are just sitting here leaking out information. And we have like our 20 people who have an interest in our website, but you know this is our hobby, right? This is not what we're planning to do as our career. You know, I run the site about librarian detectives, not because I can make money on it, although I think I can, but because it's just something I'm interested in. The information leaks out, people know more about me, and I get stalkers and weird librarian detective people and all those sides of fame, but it's a sideline. And a good thing too, because we have a name for people who simply pursue fame for fame's sake. And we also, you know, have punishments that we arrange for them, and we call those punishments reality TV shows. Right? And also, we're also weirdly condemnatory if people become accidentally famous as well. And the example that kind of stuck in my mind recently is the discussion of the nanny. Did everybody see this story? The story about the nanny blogger. It's great, like a Roald Dahl. Tales of the Unexpected. She blocked! The nanny blogger is basically nanny who blocked. God, this is so exciting. But you know, the twist in the tale, as Roald would say, is that some New Yorker woman wrote about it in New York magazine. Oh God, it's still very uninteresting. The most fascinating part of this was how everyone's going, well, she shouldn't have told her employer that she wrote a blog, and it's all her fault, because she was very upset, this nanny, that all her secrets have been published in the New York magazine. And we have this punishment already prearranged for people who leak information and become accidentally famous and suffer the breaches of privacy that the very rich protect themselves against. We're basically saying, well, they shouldn't have given away that information. They should keep themselves to themselves. And this is kind of the irritation we have with a lot of, you know, like journal people and stuff like that. It's very little sympathy is reserved for those who make a name for themselves. I think this is probably going to be a bit problematic, and I think we might have a different behavior coming up, because, well, for one thing, it's very interesting that people say this. I've seen people post this in comments going, well, she shouldn't have revealed herself as having an opinion, as I have just done. And, you know, it's very like those Slashdot comments of going, oh God, just another bloody news story about people. I hate people who comment on sites. Oh God, blogs. Who would ever post a comment to a blog? Oh God. And you know, columnists saying, oh, why is everyone talking about blogs and giving their opinion about blogs? I completely hate people who give their opinion about blogs. Mood angry, listening to my own voice. By condemning people who leak information, like they're pissing their pants, is that we ourselves are leaking information. We ourselves are establishing our own point of view. Now, of course, the argument against this is that, well, we're being anonymous, right? We are, you know, Secusha 23 or whatever. We're sitting there and we're not revealing ourselves. We're merely delivering a factual opinion that will float and land onto the interweb. And we're not being big-headed or anything about this, but this is probably where I should wrap up and give a plug for the people who let me come here, is that anonymity is not easy. And the assumption that we are anonymous is not easy, because as all this information leaks out, we're all leaking out information, what serves as an identifier for who we are becomes much harder to predict, particularly retrospectively. Look, let me give you an example. And again, you'll excuse me if my examples are merely here because I find them really funny. Let's see, here we go, Safari. This is, you've probably all seen this, is A9's street map there. And for the people who spent all that time getting my web interface to work, this is the only time I will use it. So this is the EFF, this is where I work, and we do a lot of work sort of protecting anonymity, and we kind of are realizing just how hard it is. And I can point this out because this, by the way, does everybody know what this is? No, okay, I can explain this really easily. Basically, if you type in an address into a9.com, which is Amazon's, service, it will show you a picture of where you are. They basically sent a man around, possibly two men, around the whole of America, with a big van and a camera, and just filmed every street corner. So you can see I just got this by typing in the EFF's address, and you can see zoom ups of everywhere around this. Actually, the weird thing about this is that the Google was going to do this, investigated this, and published a few papers on how to do it. I presume either like just hired the people who came up with the papers or whatever. But it's really easy to do. It takes 3 months. You can pretty much cover most of America's business areas in 3 months just by driving and stitching this stuff together. So this is the EFF. What's interesting about this picture is you see this guy here. This is our attorney in charge of privacy. Kevin Baxter, ladies and gentlemen, having a cigarette. Bag outside the okay, that's not the point of this. That's not what I was going to say, but I just find it really funny. So what's funny about this is that you can combine this with something else. This is a recent thing in New Scientist, and this is from Cambridge. And this is a system that a bunch of the AI kids at Cambridge are working on. And really, basically, you kind of see this spelled out, but what you do here is if you have an photo, you take a photo, and it can look at the photo, because buildings are basically a bunch of like vertical and horizontal lines, it can work out the orientation, it can distort it, show the orientation, and then it can pick out the salient points and identify where that is, anywhere in Cambridge. So with this bit of information here, this bit of AI, and this kind of data, what you have is something that you can feed into your some of these Flickr photos for the last 5 years or whatever, and which are all dated, and get the information they've taken the photograph, and work out where people were. Anyone who has ever posted anything on Usenet between 1989 and 1994 will recognize this as a retrospective privacy invasion. Basically, you don't know what information you're leaking out in a sort of joyful way is suddenly going to reveal far more about you than you previously thought. In the same way as people posting to Usenet going, you suck, didn't realize that when they were vice president of the United States a few years later, people would be able to dig this stuff out. I'm going to wrap up with no conclusions very carefully because I haven't come up with any. But look, I'm all out of time. One of the things that I just wanted to sort of wrap up here with is that is this idea that you have two choices in the current situation. You have the choice of either having no voice at all or of slowly leaking out information into a medium that preserves that information and will continue to build correlations and connections between that and build a portrait of you. When we describe this about a government or a single organization, we see this as an invasion of privacy. When we see this being done by a whole culture, it's fake, because you have a lot of people who know something about you, and you don't know who they are. And I think one of the big questions that we're going to have at the moment is, do we all get to be famous and see that as a positive thing? Or do we all realize that this isn't fame at all? This has none of the advantages of fame. And in fact, what we are all suffering from here is an invasion of privacy. And that's something that we have to correct.
Did you mention, I only caught the end of the Princess Diana one. Was I mentioned?
I was mentioned.
What we've got now, Dan, is an exciting overlap and a tantalising glimpse of our next speaker. But we do have time for you to take some questions. So I'm sure there are questions. Yeah.
Okay.
What time do you think? What? Like, what? Well, you've got questions for yourself?
they
have to. Do we have questions? Like, let's see a show of hands. A question for, well, I'll hand this to you. Oh. But if you move to the middle, then someone will set up their laptop over here. But don't look over there. Keep your eyes on me. Don't unplug it. Well, all right. Be less distracted. So, our first question over there. Well, in fact, see if that microphone works now, and then I'll run around like Kilroy.
I just wanted to know what it's like being famous.
See, I thought this would crop up. I am so not fucking famous. I'm now in that situation.
Anyone got a better question than that? Just put your hand up, or you can have time on this one, Dad.
No.
Okay. What's it like not being famous? My question is, and I don't know, you know, this is what we were discussing on the internet, obviously, in a public forum. Do you worry that it's worth, like that thing in, has anyone seen that movie, the prequel to The Silence of the Lambs, where he selects his victims by going through the photos that
they submit? Where are you going with this, Dad?
I'm just saying, because all of us are sticking stuff on Flickr, and I'm not saying I'm a psychotic stalker or anything like that, but we should all look out for that.
So,
that's actually a point masquerading as a question. So one of the things that is interesting is being a friend of the famous, and I don't think this is weird. And one of the things that does come out of a lot of the discussion about this is what happens when somebody you know leaks information like a sieve, and you're in their Flickr photos. One of the things that was I didn't put it in the talk, but it was kind of weird, was the guy who is probably here, who wrote a summary of all the speakers, including photos of them at the beach. And one speaker's legs, and they basically got this by doing the kind of thing that I described, that they googled for them, they picked out lots of information, and summarized it in a form that suddenly everybody else would find. Now, a lot of those pictures were of those people taken by other people, and then tagged as my friend Phil or whatever, and this is just this extra bit of where, the simple keeping this stuff within a friend's circle is never going to help. Are there any other questions?
A question from Hammersley. Hand up the mic.
In the future, will it be possible for those, reclusive billionaires to remain reclusive? Or would you see the head of fame taking everyone?
That's a really good question. And it's one of those things which really separates the techno-utopian men from the techno-cynical boys, right? Or vice versa. It's a classic example of, is this actually a democratizing process? Or is this something which which lowers the playing field for everybody, except for those people who reserve themselves the way? I mean, honestly, just because of the nature of how much money people have when they reach the top percentage, I think if you want to keep secret, and it limits your choices in the world, but I don't think those people are going to get revealed at all.
I think, unless anyone's got any really quick questions, I think we're going to draw to a close there, if that's okay. Thank you very much, Danny O'Brien.